if you put a man in a dark room, then he will think dark thoughts. But if you put a man into an elite room, then he will think elite thoughts. Welcome to Elite Medical School, where today's subject is depression. We're going to examine our energy fields. We will be using our power and will to reduce our suffering. How's it going today, boys? Yeah.
It's going well, man. I think Dr. C's gone ahead and muted himself. Maybe because of uncontrollable sobbing, given that he's suffering a major depressive episode. Oh, he's back online.
Sorry. I'm just moving to a different location because it's just a little bit of noise here. So just bear with me for a second.
Doctor, I thank you so much for that introduction. I think I'm as excited as you are today to talk about major depression.
Oh, of course. This is not only important for your exams, because this is an extremely high yield topic. You're basically guaranteed to see some sort of mood disorder, but most likely depression on your exams. But it's also going to be wildly important to your practice. 10% lifetime prevalence of MDD in the general population. So you're certainly going to encounter these patients.
Absolutely. If not, your colleagues or you yourself might be afflicted. So listen closely. So why don't we just jump right into things? Dr. I, how might one define major depressive disorder? What does a patient presentation look like? We're fortunate because Dr. C is afflicted with so many illnesses, with so many comorbidities, that we can basically use him as a patient presentation for, the whole STI unit, most of the psychiatry unit. So what might Dr. C present to your ambulatory care clinic or your psychiatric clinic? How might he present?
If we go based on our classic DSM-5 criteria, there's a few things that you will be looking out for. It's very important to memorize the criteria. It's a little monotonous, but you got to do what you got to do. And it is the following. So for a period of 2 weeks, there is a series of symptoms, and one of which has to be a depressed mood or a loss of interest or pleasure in regular activities, which is known as anhedonia. The nine symptoms that you should memorize can be, you should know the acronym MSIGICAPS. So M for mood, we discussed, and then S is for sleep. So people will experience disturbed sleep, most likely early morning awakening or initial insomnia. So it's useful to ask individuals to record the number of hours, tell them exactly for them to tell you exactly how much they've been sleeping, characterize the number of nocturnal emissions.
Nocturnal emissions, absolutely.
Yeah. I is for interest, which is that lack of interest or anhedonia, as we discussed. And then G is for guilt. So usually surrounding some past misdeed, a bit of an exaggerated response. So, if there's a lot of guilt about fapping the last day, they might be really distraught about it. Low energy, as opposed to like the high energy you would see with something like mania. People just don't have.
Or being like alpha.
Or yeah.
It's very much like a beta.
Yeah. Yeah, just think of the Chad versus the Virgin meme, and when you see the Virgin, that's your MSE for depressed patient.
Right. It's just sort of a mnemonic device.
Yeah. We've also got impaired concentration. So typically what I like to ask patients is, when they're watching TV or reading a book, how well are they able to focus on that? Are they able to keep up with what's going on? Especially useful in the elderly. Appetite. That's a big one. That's A. It could be increased or decreased depending on how they're using food to cope. And P is for psychomotor retardation or potentially agitation, but most likely psychomotor retardation. They physically slow down, which is especially prevalent in like the severe subtype of the illness. And finally, we have suicidality. We, you know, there is this risk of ideation and potentially acting on those thoughts. You know, you should ask about it even if they don't mention it. This is also very key, very high yield for any exam or patient assessment. It will be necessary to assess their safety and whether they're safe to go home and what kind of activities have they been engaging in. Now, Dr. C, I'll ask you a common question. Does asking about suicidal ideation, does that increase the risk of suicide?
Does it increase the risk of suicide?
Yeah, like if I ask a depressed patient, are you feeling suicidal? Is that going to provoke them in any way to you know, put a gun in their
head? I mean, it's possible. I don't know any data on that. I would doubt it.
Yeah. So the data
studies on that.
The data shows that there actually is not an increased risk of suicide by asking about that. And oftentimes patients will be thankful that you are the one that brought up the subject because it can be difficult to bring up on their own. So it's actually very useful to ask about it when you can. Do not be shy. Now, what are we going with?
You can call me whatever you want, baby. You can call me daddy. You can call me just whatever you like.
Dr. Shit. what was I going to ask? Oh, yeah. You know, this is like a pretty checklisty list that we have here. How would you go about asking these questions to make it seem like maybe more of a natural conversation?
Well, you might, practically speaking, actually get the patient to do it while they're on an iPad in the waiting room, because you only have 15 minutes. but yeah, I mean, the alternative to that, yeah, would be to incorporate this sort of conversationally. I'm not sure if you're getting at some tool in particular, but yeah, rather than sort of, you know, itemizing things, I think incorporating it conversationally is valuable, so that you don't get sort of yes or no responses, and the patient may elaborate on their symptoms in a way that's more informative.
Yeah, I think one of the key ways of gathering this history is to use open-ended questions. How have they been dealing with their mood? Why exactly are they presenting to you then and there? And to not neglect the psychosocial aspect. So what has been going on in their lives, reviewing their medical history as well. On that note, what else would we be asking about in an interview for a depressed patient?
I would imagine we would want to ask a lot about any substance use.
That's true. Substance use is very important. So, you know, we want to consider kind of the illicit substances, including cannabis, alcohol, stimulants. You know, we want to think about things like stimulant withdrawal. Basically, any sort of illicit substances will have some sort of impact on mood. But we also want to consider prescribed medications as well. So are they taking something like a beta blocker, or are they on benzos? From their previous family doctor who prescribed it 2 milligrams Q4H for anxiety. You know, what is it that they're taking, and how is that impacting their mood as well? Anything else we would want to ask about?
Yeah, so those comorbidities or other, you know, the differential. And in terms of treatment, you may have to rule out things like manic symptoms. Some of our medications, like SSRIs, theoretically can unmask mania. So screening for that as well will be useful.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I would add with the anxiety also would be useful to assess for eating disorders as well. Now, I just realized that I didn't go through all of the DSM criteria. So the first part that I mentioned, the 5 out of 9 over the last 2 weeks, that's criteria A. B, we want to make sure that to qualify for MDD, that the symptoms are resulting in clinically significant distress and an impairment in their function, which includes social, occupational, you know, other important areas of their life are affected by these symptoms. And C, we want to ensure that this episode is not wholly attributable to the physiological effects of a substance or another medical condition. So we do want to get a thorough history of their medical, of their past medical history. And just to round it out, D, that this isn't better explained by psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, delusional disorder. And E, that there has never been a manic episode or a hypomanic episode, because as Dr. T said, with some of the treatments, we do have a risk of exacerbating a manic episode if improperly diagnosed. And this MDD diagnosis does come with a variety of specifiers, severity levels ranging from mild to severe, and it can present with psychotic features as well as anxiety, melancholic features. If they've been reading Tolstoy recently, you know, catatonia, all that good stuff. So what would we, you know, talking about the medical history, what kind of things would we be concerned about from a medical perspective with depression as part of our differential?
Right. So from a medical perspective, you want to rule out quote unquote organic illness. So common mimetics of depression include things like hypothyroidism, electrolyte disturbance, including extended electrolytes. So consider your magnesium, calcium, phosphate. Things like B12 deficiency, especially in the elderly, can present with neurologic changes. Folate deficiency, post-stroke syndrome is a common mimetic. So those will be all assessable on blood work. Go ahead.
Yeah, with the neurological, I would also add Parkinson's, MS, and epilepsy. Those are commonly associated with depression as well, especially on exams. And endocrinologically, we also want to consider things like Addison's disease and Cushing's. And not an uncommon contributor to mood and some of these symptoms is obstructive sleep apnea. So try to get a good sleep history as well. With these medical considerations, what would be a reasonable panel of investigations that we can order for a patient that's presenting to kind of like a primary care setting?
Right. So in terms of blood work, routinely, you might consider getting CBC, especially anemia can manifest that way. Like I spoke about electrolytes, kidney disease can cause all sorts of neurologic dysfunction, so kidney function. Your TSH for thyroid, folate B12, as we spoke about. LFTs, things like hepatitis, HIV can manifest that way as well. Some people would advocate for diabetes screening, in the appropriate age group. I routinely would do a urine tox in the appropriate patient. And that sort of can affect what treatments you might be ordering. And yes, apropos of that as well, an ECG to screen for prolonged QT, probably not in the young, otherwise unmedicated patient, but if they're on any other medications or QT prolongating agents, you might consider an ECG.
Yeah, exactly. And with that urine tox, if you are considering substance use being an influencer of their presentation, then try to assess for whether the symptoms persist without substance use. You know, try to find some longer periods of sobriety and assess their mood and functioning and symptoms then. All right. So anything else we'd like to add in that assessment?
Yeah, throw in a testosterone check.
Yeah, and the appropriate patient. Absolutely.
That's a good thought. Older men.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially if they have any, you know, related symptoms. Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
Yeah. That's very good. I would also, I think, as part of any psychiatric exam, I would also screen for things like psychosis. As part of your general mental status examination questioning, ask about auditory and visual hallucinations and all that good stuff. Any delusional thought content. As part of your characterization of this mood, try to get an idea of how long it's been. You do want to consider other depressive type disorders on your differential, like dysthymia, where the symptoms last for 2 years or longer, but are typically milder than what you would see in major depressive disorder. And also consider things like adjustment disorder with depressive features. Ask about any recent stressors if they do have an impact, if there has been an impact on their functioning, but they do not necessarily meet the criteria for major depressive disorder.
I think that's sufficient to diagnose. Are there any sort of high yield, like, let's say that you don't necessarily have time to go through a an extensive diagnostic questionnaire. Are there any, do you guys recall any screening questions for at-risk patients? To read my mind. The
PHQ-9.
PHQ. Yeah, there's actually a PHQ-2, which has a 96% sensitivity, apparently, for MDD. And that is as follows. During the past 2 months, have you often been bothered by the following: being down, depressed, or hopeless, little interest or pleasure in doing things. So essentially, if they answer no to both of those questions, you've essentially ruled out depression.
Right. Yeah, I've got it pulled up now, and I mean, there it is. Those are the mandatory symptoms for a MDD diagnosis: the low mood and the anhedonia. Those make up the PHQ-2. They're very useful. Yeah, but PHQ-9—that's what typically what you would see in any research study. Maybe the Hamilton Depression Scale as well. Those are the big ones. All right, so how are we going to go about managing this? We've got an understanding of their energy fields, and we're just determining that perhaps they are attracting more horror than goodness in their lives. How do we purify their hearts?
Right. So how are we going to purify their hearts? How are we going to exorcise the demon of depression? Well, fortunately, there's a pill that can cure any history of trauma, things like low self-esteem due to poor body habitus, low self-esteem due to low IQ, or unfulfilling jobs and relationships. So that's packaged in all into one pill, fortunately. Not. So no, that's not an option. So principles of management are sort of multimodal,
I thought you were talking
and
about
are,
Percocets.
yeah. It are through sort of a biopsychosocial lens. So it's holistic in spirit.
Yeah.
It's a very holistic approach. But why not? We can start, if you'd like, with medical therapy. That is pharmacotherapy. So what are you currently taking, Dr. C, in addition to your antipsychotics?
In addition to my antipsychotics, I'm taking escitalopram, 15 milligrams daily, and dextroamphetamine, 30 milligrams daily, or Vyvanse, pardon me. And both of those I find quite helpful for depression. Vyvanse, actually, surprisingly so.
Oh, interesting. Vyvanse for depression. Yeah, and you see, I think Ritalin more often, especially for anhedonic depression, but more as an adjunct. So in terms of first line therapy, or let's refer back to our regional expert, Dr. I. What are your first line considerations?
Well, the Ciprolex or Escitalopram, that's that belongs to a class of antidepressants called SSRIs. That's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Some other names that you may recognize are sertraline or citalopram, fluoxetine. There's quite a few that you will encounter. We also have SNRIs, including norepinephrine in addition to the serotonin reuptake inhibition. So that would include drugs like venlafaxine and duloxetine. And then we have NDRIs, so norepinephrine and dopamine, which the most common one you'll encounter is bupropion. And then we have the atypical...
Sorry to mess up your flow there. Bupropion is also known as Wellbutrin.
Wellbutrin, yeah. Or Zyban. Yeah,
Zyban with the smoking cessation indication.
Yeah, exactly. So for those that can't stop hacking those darts, that's a good one. And the atypical antidepressants, the NASSA, which is mirtazapine. Otherwise known as Remeron. The NASSA, I always forget what that stands for, to be honest, but it's...
Well, let's take a moment, if you don't mind. Yeah. I'll talk a little bit about some other considerations while you look that up, because it's interesting. Yeah. So in terms of, contraindications, which is always important, and this one comes up in particular let's start with Wellbutrin or Bupropion, is the... history of seizure. So I've actually seen this. That is, Wellbutrin does lower the seizure threshold. So if anyone has a history of seizure or seizure predisposing illness, especially alcoholism, be careful with that medication and certainly caution the patient. So history of seizure is an absolute contraindication to that medication. Maybe psychiatry would prescribe it outside of that setting, but the primary care setting, you probably wouldn't want to be prescribing that. In terms of SSRIs, as we spoke about, and SNRIs for that matter, as we spoke about previously, history of bipolar illness or psychotic illness, especially bipolar illness, is relevant. Oftentimes, if you see people on SSRIs with, for example, bipolar 2, they'll be on some mood stabilizer in addition. So those are some important contraindications. These medications, as we spoke about before, are QT prolongating. But you know, frankly, QT in men QTC that is less than 400, or in women less than 380, is nothing to get too fussed about. Don't get too worried about that or caught up on that. So those are some contraindications. What else? In terms of appetite suppression, especially with the SNRIs and the Wellbutrin, that characteristic with the Wellbutrin in particular can be sort of leveraged if there's a weight loss goal. Smoking cessation, as we spoke about. Any other important contraindications that you wanted to highlight there, guys?
Not really. Bupropion, you know, with that, the activating nature of it, it might induce some anxiety if that's comorbid, and insomnia. So maybe timing of the medication or the dose, pay particular attention to that. But I think that's that covers it quite well. Now, Dr. C, if you don't mind me asking, what are some side effects that you might have encountered on your 15 milligrams escitalopram PO daily?
I can't get hard anymore at all.
At all?
I haven't had an erection since I began the treatment.
Oh my goodness.
I haven't had an erection since I began the treatment.
Sorry,
that sucks, dude.
Are you still busting?
No, not at all, man. There's nothing.
So there's no pre-erectile ejaculation?
No. Fortunately, the SSRI tames the
premature ejaculation.
Yeah, but also the soft ejaculations that I was experiencing.
So what do you, are you, have you just been an incel then since that time?
Oh yeah.
I guess it's sort of Volcel, right? In that there's court order for you to take that medication.
Yeah, no, it's like Volcel, and I don't really have much of a sex drive either, so it doesn't really bother me. It's a new life, man. It's chill.
Well, the good thing is there's a whole sort of culture. It's sort of a movement. Are you leaning MGTOW at all or not particularly?
I am a member of the regional chapter, yes. But I'm not leading, but I am a member.
Any other side effects?
Yeah, dude, I gained like 50 pounds.
Oh, shit. Usually when it's prescribed to prevent GI discomfort, it's recommended to take the medication with food. Now, Dr. C unfortunately does a mukbang every time he takes his medication, which can result in a 50-pound weight increase. Some other things to watch out for.
I'm sorry, a mukbang? Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, have you ever seen those videos online where people like gorge themselves on food and they just, that's the appeal of is watching people just fatten up.
It's very lucrative.
Yeah, it is kind of appealing.
It's like ASMR, but you know, it's a little more, a little tastier.
Nice. Okay. I'll check that out.
Yeah, it's good. Speaking of food, another common but less of a serious side effect is loss of appetite, anorexia, and insomnia may result as well. But that sexual dysfunction aspect, you know, we joke a lot around here on the Elite Medical School podcast, but that is a pretty common side effect. And these common side effects, you know, they might result in patients not taking their medication consistently and giving it a fair trial. You know, typically you hear that SSRIs take 2 to 4, sometimes 6 weeks to work, especially for the cognitive and the mood aspect. But I, in my readings, the highest rate of mood improvement is actually in the first week. So after a week, there should be some sort of improvement noted from an SSRI. So we discussed a little bit about the common side effects, but maybe the less serious ones. I mean, the sexual dysfunction one, that's very serious, but can we think of some other more uncommon, but much more serious side effects from taking this an SSRI, for example?
Yeah. What if you took, Dr. C, you may have run into this. So on the days where you were taking ecstasy with your amphetamine, with your SSRI, did you experience any symptoms of serotonin overdose? Like, for example, flushing, tachycardia, rapid heart rate, excess sweating, diarrhea, any of those types of pupil dilation, any of those types of symptoms?
Yeah, the only time I did it was Molly, and I did it one time. I took Molly on the SSRI, and I was so drunk that I don't really remember much, but there was a lot of puking. And felt like shit the next day, but I don't remember specific symptoms that I had while on it. But I was puking for like hours. It was bad, man.
Yeah, I bet that is like nausea is probably part of the serotonin syndrome. I don't remember it as being a classic feature, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
what we're getting at here is serotonin syndrome. As we alluded to earlier, there's going to be changes in the vitals, so hypertension, tachycardia, tachypnea, hyperthermia may be present as well, and the skin will be diaphoretic. there would be increased tone in the muscles, especially in the lower extremities. And you might even notice some hyperreflexia or clonus on your neuro exam.
Oh yeah, clonus.
Clonus is a big one. That's actually what is going to, little pearl here, it's going to help you differentiate from neuroleptic malignant syndrome, because clinically they might appear very similar. In serotonin syndrome, you'll have that hyperreflexia and clonus, as opposed to an NMS where you'll have hyporeflexia.
Is rigidity a classic feature of serotonin syndrome? You spoke about increased tone in the lower extremity.
Yeah, there is increased tone, but in NMS you'll have more of a lead pipe rigidity. That's going to be the key in differentiating those. There's a lot of overlap otherwise. A lot of with serotonin syndrome also you might see agitation, but in if it's more severe, then they might even have maybe closer to a coma instead. Yeah, it's rough, and the, you know, that is an emergent emergency situation. In addition to serotonin syndrome, what other serious side effect, somewhat, I guess you can consider a side effect, but what else will we be thinking of that we would be worried about with SSRI?
Yeah. So there's a theoretic risk of increased suicidality. I think that's been mostly debunked, but to the extent that it's sort of activating, people could carry out suicidal plans, perhaps. And it was a black box warning, but I don't think that the data sort of holds up, but certainly, you know, documenting that is a thought.
Yeah. And honestly, even though the data is sketchy, I would say when you're thinking about this, this risk of suicidality, think of age as a protective factor. So in adolescence, maybe you might see some increased suicidal thoughts, but I don't think there's an increased risk of completed suicides. But ultimately, this is an opportunity to talk about, you know, what to do if the thoughts do get darker, if their energy becomes a little more dark, to let them know about what resources are available, to let them know about emergency psychiatry services, who to contact.
Document that you've shared the crisis line. I mean, Dr. C, you've become sort of friendly at this stage with your crisis line worker. In fact, he's sort of expects a call from you on Saturdays just to catch up. Do you find that those resources are protective against suicide?
Definitely, man. I
what's his name again? Your crisis worker?
Roger.
Roger.
Yeah. He's a good guy, man.
You guys just kind of shoot the shit.
Yeah. We just every Sunday we just like call at the same time. We just chat. Not much talk about suicide though. But he's he's a great dude. I think he's very effective.
That's good.
Talk therapy is important, and we will get to that. One more thing I wanted to cover before going on, withdrawal symptoms of SSRIs. So those that start their SSRIs, they're a few days in, and then they go out to the club. You know, they're getting a little drunk, a little loose. Things are going good. They start talking to a cutie. They take her home. Lo and behold, it's a tenus. You know, it's a nightmarish situation, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. In tears, our hypothetical individual. Yeah, they run out.
It's the belly of the beast. Sorry,
they flush their pills down the toilet out of frustration. What are they likely to experience as part of the withdrawal from SSRIs?
Dude, the brain zaps, man.
I think that's more classically SNRIs, but I suppose, like, especially
I definitely got brain zaps when I came off my SSRI.
Now, can you elaborate on what that is?
Yeah, it's like you're walking, and then all of a sudden you feel like like Brain Zap kind of describes it nice, like subjectively pretty well, but it's like you're walking and then you kind of get this energy inside, but you're also like really dizzy for a second and kind of stumble, and then you're back like a couple seconds later. But that'll happen all throughout the day. It sucks.
Now, Dr. C, are those Brain Zaps, are they being caused by any sort of government agents, or maybe the police is inducing these zaps in your mind?
No, man, I think that it's just the SSRI withdrawal.
Okay, all right. Yeah. We'll check in with Roger later and we'll see about that. So the shock sensations, that could be one of the withdrawal symptoms. Some of the other ones that you would consider, dizziness, nausea and vomiting, agitation, insomnia, anxiety, you know, you just feel like shit. A lot of people describe it as kind of like flu-like symptoms. Feels like you have the flu. And I think paroxetine is one of the more common medications that you might be tested on that might result in those symptoms. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of, I think it's like in turn it has a relatively or comparatively short half-life, whereas a lot of the first line now that is you know, fluoxetine, sertraline, Zoloft, Ciprolex, escitalopram all have longer half-lives and therefore are less likely to have sort of precipitous withdrawal symptoms.
Dr. T, you're sounding a little prodromal to me. What's going on, buddy?
Let's talk. You know, I'll take a sip. I'll take a sip of caffeine. Here, let's get... What I'll do is I'll pinch my scrotum. That sometimes wakes me up.
Yeah, hang your weight from your glance.
A dual purpose. It's both stimulating and it jokes you. It's elongating and stimulating.
Now, speaking of jelking, what other first line treatments might we consider in addition to SSRIs?
Cardio,
exactly. Exercise, that's not going to hurt. I don't know what the data is on that, but you got to recommend it to everyone. Use it or lose it. You'll feel better if you go outside, lift some weights.
Use it or lose it. Yeah, fair point. That's what you should tell the patient.
Yeah.
Get yoked, dude. I believe that cardiovascular exercise, actually, I don't believe I have empirical evidence for this. Cardiovascular exercise is superior to, for example, weightlifting, and high intensity exercise for anxiety in particular is better than low intensity. So as best they can, encourage them to you know, more intensive exercise.
Yeah, really try to get the heart rate up, you know. A walk is one thing. You know, playing cock hero is one thing. But you know, you wanna, I mean, unless it's a very vigorous advanced level of cock hero, then maybe that'll be enough to make it go away.
What is cock hero?
Don't act like you don't know, Dr. T. You're not fooling anyone.
Yeah, I hear it in the background.
I don't.
Yeah, it's like Guitar Hero, but you fap in rhythm with the music that's playing with the porn.
That's fantastic. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, that there's a genre, isn't there, about sort of instructional. So I guess it sort of falls within that genre. Anyhow, okay, so cock hero, yeah.
Cock hero.
Is that an adjunct treatment?
I mean, it's contraindicated if you're on NOFAP, but if you're, it can help out for the severely morbidly obese that might not be able to fit out the door to go for a proper walk. What I actually was hoping to discuss was psychotherapies. Any thoughts on talking with a social worker, a psychologist, about what's going on in your life? Is that an effective therapy?
I bottle up my emotions. in that I actually keep jars of my tears. I mean it quite literally, in that I keep jars of my tears on my mantle to remind me of my own torment and the just the nihilistic meaninglessness of everything. So yeah, for that reason, I tend not to talk to people.
Yeah, Dr. Doomer today has hacked too many darts. He's bringing down my vibe right now.
Dr. Gooner.
Yeah, so, I mean, psychotherapy, it will really depend on what's available in your area. Psychotherapy, for exam purposes, you would really want to be thinking about CBT. A lot of people don't really understand what CBT is, but basically, if we're to summarize it, it's learning to recognize and break down your pathological thought patterns in a pretty logical way, using that mindfulness to influence your reaction to stressors and ultimately your mood. CBT would be considered one of the first line treatments for psychotherapy and for depression, and it can be, you know, you can combine psychotherapy and meds for treatment as well, maybe especially indicated in things like chronic depression. And I think those with early childhood trauma, you know, maybe an elevated ACE score that's contributing to their low mood, then those that patient population tends to have improved outcomes with psychotherapy as well.
Sorry, the ACE score?
Like their adverse childhood experiences. So those that have early childhood trauma specifically typically do better with psychotherapy as one of the treatments for the depression. Yeah, you know, we can also consider things like interpersonal therapy, where we can focus on things like grief or recent psychosocial changes in their lives, help them build those relationship and coping skills. Mindfulness therapy, a lot of overlap with CBT, but you really can't go wrong with adding CBT to your exam answers. Anyway, sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I usually add CBD to most of my exam answers because it has sort of turned out to be a bit of a panacea in that it's effective for depression, erectile dysfunction, schizophrenia, marijuana addiction. So it can be very useful as an adjunct.
Yeah, chronic pain. My very first prescription was Nabilone.
Is that right?
That's yeah. Prescribed it for...
it's very appropriate.
Somebody with cannabis deficiency.
Cannabis deficiency disorder.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that was a useful discussion of adjuncts.
Do you boys...
Go
ahead.
No, please. By all means.
Do you boys want to talk about some neurostimulation?
Absolutely. I think that could be a stimulating conversation.
Hell yeah. Now, Dr. C, when you hear electroconvulsive therapy, what does that bring about in your mind?
Dude, fucking the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah. That's pretty much everyone's reaction when I bring that up, which is unfortunate because this is one of the silver bullets in psychiatry. ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, has an effectiveness of 80-90% in the general depressed patients, and 50-60% respond if they are treatment resistant to previous medications. Basically, ECT, it's an induction of a seizure administered under anesthesia, usually 8 to 12 rounds over a period of weeks, and is actually very effective for a variety of things. Let's see, I had a list here somewhere, but it's basically for everything, like mania, depression, psychosis. It helps out with all of that, with minimal side effects. Really, the main one that you would want to think about is memory loss. It includes both anterograde and retrograde, and that memory fuzziness can last for months. So usually not that long, but it can be that long. And ECT, there is a lot of stigma around it. Actually, when I was watching a YouTube video on just depression management, seeing kind of like the topic in general, and the guy presenting was like, and you know, there's also ECT, but personally, I think that's barbaric, and I don't see why anybody would choose to do that. So we're just going to skip over that section. and it's like a solid YouTube video that's like highly ranked in the search for major depressive disorder treatment. So a lot of stigma even amongst the medical community. So it is highly effective, but typically I would say in your day-to-day practice, it will be reserved for people with severe depression, psychotic depression, those with catatonia, those where that are treatment resistant, maybe with if their function is severe such that they're unable to take care of themselves, ECT should be considered. And it does have a rapid improvement in these patients as well. Anything you guys want to add to that? Are we still there?
Yeah, we're still here. Now that's sounds complete.
Nice. It looks like we've lost Dr. T.
Where's he gone?
I think he just texted me a picture of a noose. That's weird.
Strange.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he just texted me saying he's got to head out. All right. That was basically a whirlwind tour of depression. Any final thoughts, Dr. C? Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, no, just fucking throw them on the SSRIs, man. No, it's good shit.
Yeah, one of our friends said that he went to a few family doctors before being able to be prescribed an SSRI.
Really?
Right away. Yeah. I don't want to say the name on the air, but he told that story.
That sounds unusual.
Yeah. He told the story of like he went to the first family doc, and the doc said, "Well, you know, you're new to me in this walk-in. Like, I don't feel comfortable prescribing it to you." Goes to another family doc. He's like, "Yeah, I would be willing to prescribe it to you, but I want to follow you for a couple of weeks before we do that." And then he's like, "Screw that." He goes to a third doctor. The third doctor says, "I think Cipralex should be in the water supply." Immediately right, prescribes it. Yeah. So that's,
yeah, now I know what friend you're talking about now.
Yeah. So everybody has their own level of comfort with how to manage depression, with, you know, their own ideas around what the cause of depression is. You know, you can talk with a psychoanalytical psychiatrist. They'll chalk it all up to you being stuck on the oral phase of your development or whatever. And others will believe that there is a purely organic cause for all mood dysfunction. But ultimately, we know that we can purify our heart through gratitude. That we're, as long as we reach our highest vibrational state, then we will be blessed and grateful. We're only here for quality energy. So long
as we're supplementing our CBD.
Yes, exactly. CBD. Yeah. It keeps your life from becoming hell. So on that note, God bless you.